Hello and welcome to the Irish Times Culture Podcast. We have a panel of writers here today, whittled down after from a lengthy long list to a controversial short list. We've got a journalist, Irish Times journalist and writer of many books, too many to mention, Fintan O'Toole.
Too many, full stop.
We have a journalist and music writer and new novelist, the author of The Real Rebecca, Anna Carey. Hello, Anna.
Hello.
And we have thriller writer, journalist and blogger, Crime Always Pays, really the centre of the Irish crime writing world, Declan Burke. And Declan, I'm going to start with you because you've done something really interesting at the moment and you're writing about this in Wednesday's Irish Times. Tell me what it is.
Well, the piece in the Irish Times is about e-publishing and e-books, covering a strata of unpublished authors or indie authors, or as they're referred to in the States, who are not conventionally published but are publishing, you know, straight to digitally publishing. And as well as that, at the other end, best-selling authors such as the thriller writer Stephen Leather, who is personally digitising his back catalogue and seems to be earning as much from his e-book adventures as he is from his more conventional publishing.
You've done something specific with your first novel, Eight Ball Boogie.
That's right. I had a novel that was published about 8 years ago now with Lilliput, and it was a thriller. It was a privatised story set in Sligo, as you do, and it didn't do particularly well, as most thrillers or crime novels tend not to do in Ireland. And a couple of months ago, I was thinking about popping it up there as an e-book to try and give it, you know, another set of legs. And the publisher asked, would I be interested in buying out the rights, which I was. And it's really an experiment in throwing out a few seeds because I have a novel coming in September, so it's kind of trying to build up some early words, some buzz on the blogs, etc. But yeah, it's been a very interesting experiment so far.
You put it up at what price is it?
It's 99 cents or 86p. It's when you publish through Amazon through the Kindle program, there are two alternatives. You can publish at a certain level, and that allows you really to attract a much wider audience, and that's why I pitched it at such a low price. And plus, because it was a book that had been published 8 years ago, I didn't want people to think that they were being, you know, ripped off. And at 99 cents, you know, who's not going to take a gamble on four or five chapters? If it doesn't suit you, then, you know, you've lost a dollar.
This is one of the interesting things now about what you've done, which is, I think any writer who's walked into a bargain basement bookshop,
mm-hmm.
And there are so many books at the moment, or so many shops at the moment, certainly popping up in, say, Grafton Street, right, where it's like Euro books.
Mm-hmm.
And if you walk in, you see your book on sale for 99 cents, mm-hmm. it would be pretty hard to take. So what's the difference between doing that? You know, because you were saying actually the experiment has been quite good for you. It's been quite interesting. You get an opportunity clearly to have a book which at the moment would be out of print, actually in print and available to anybody who read mm-hmm. it. So, you know, what is the difference, do you think?
Well, I suppose one essential difference is that if you decide to price it at 99 cents, you know, but I'm not particularly egotistical when it comes to that kind of thing. I really am not. For me, what ego is involved is in the actual writing of it. Once it's published, which is almost like a necessary evil at times, and it's out there, then it takes on a life of its own. And how it's priced and all those extra elements that come, you know, once you've personally as a writer crossed the finishing line, I never really got involved with that. And publishing as an e-book, you become your own publisher, you become your own publicist, etc. So it's a fascinating experiment in learning the trade from the grassroots up, you know, right from writing the first line of the book to, you know, getting it out there and, you know, approaching various blogs, you know, making decisions about how to price it. And, you know, so it's a fascinating experiment. I would recommend it to any writer, and particularly if you have maybe a book or two that has fallen out of print and it's just sitting there gathering dust, then, you know, it's a good, fun thing to do. It's quite time-consuming, but, you know, it's an interesting thing.
There is no, the great thing about digital world is that nothing gathers dust in the digital world.
Well, that's one thing about it. I mean, I know it's 99 cent, it's you know, priced at the moment. A digital book will never go out of print, and that should be music to the ears of any published writer, because that's the great, you know after 2 years the book hasn't really earned out, and you know it's not selling and it falls out of print. And there's some terrific books have fallen out of print, as we all know. We all have our own favorites. A digital book is never, ever going to go out of print. You know, even if the format changes from the digital format that we have right now, it will change to another kind of digital format. As it stands, your book will never, ever go out of print, and it will be earning for the rest of your life.
Anna, as a music writer, you've watched how the music industry has changed in the last few years. You've seen how the importance of record companies has become less and less and less. Do you think there's a parallel that can be drawn with publishers and writing, that that publishers will increasingly become less important to writers, that writers will be able to get their book out there in their own way? Or is music different because live music, in a way, is the the opportunity for bands to get out there in a way that writers still don't have?
Well, I think one of the crucial differences is that writers still need editors. And I think that's something that often gets lost in the sort of hype about, you know, anyone could be their own publisher. Well, unless you're employing a really good editor, you probably can't, because there's very few people, and I think as journalists we all know this, there's very few people who can't be improved by editing. Your unfiltered genius is not necessarily good enough for the world. So that does worry me. And what does also worry me a bit, and I speak as somebody who owns a Kindle, you know, I bought a book on my Kindle today. But
what did you buy?
I bought a quite embarrassing American cookbook, which is why I usually buy quite cheesy things for my Kindle, because books I actually want to read but don't necessarily want taking up, you know, a foot of shelf space. So I do, you know, I think it's a great thing, but there's a danger that, like the music industry, we will get the sort of entitlement among, I suppose, readers, in terms of consumers, that what happened to the music industry was you get a whole generation coming up who just see music as something they should have for free. And you even see this in content-based websites. You know, I find it as frustrating as anyone when a magazine or newspaper article is behind a paywall. At the same time, I don't really have a right to have it for free. And I think there's a danger that that attitude will seep into publishing as well. I know a friend of mine who's a teen author in the UK, and a very successful teen author. She has found that a lot of people are trying to get, you know, pirated downloads of her books. Now, she won't be able to continue to write books if publishers go out of business, you know, because people are downloading books for free. So it's not even like music, where people can earn money through live tours, which has problematic in itself. So I think it's kind of a mixed blessing in a way. I think it's, you know, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong in the format itself, even though I am a huge fan of the book as a physical object. But I think it could be bad for publishing in the long run if the same thing happens as happens to the music industry, and it could.
I mean, Fintan, I travel up on the train every day, and you can get a sense gradually of the Kindle coming. Oddly, you can see the Kindle and Sony readers much more than the iPad still, but it's still the tipping point doesn't seem to be there yet in an Irish context. This is very anecdotal, but I think also in terms of sales, that we haven't quite gone, we're certainly nowhere near where they are in the States, where digital books are now beginning to outsell very clearly, certainly through Amazon are beginning to outsell physical copies of books. But do you think we're at a point where we're maybe only 2 or 3 years away from most people reading digitally, or most books being sold digitally? Are we really reaching a point at which the physical book is on its way out?
I don't think we're at a point where the physical book is on its way out, and I don't think the physical book will ever be on its way out. I mean, it's a good technology, actually. It's a very simple piece of technology. It's portable, it's recyclable, you can handle it. It's a nice piece of technology. It's been around a long time, and it will be around a long time. What tends to happen with these things is, of course, that you get something else as well. I think that's what's going to happen. I think even what Anna was saying, for example, about you'll buy certain kinds of books because you don't want them taking up shelf space, you know, or because they're more usable, perhaps, in a digital format, like cookbooks might well be. But I think people will always want certain kinds of books as physical objects. Now, this is a huge, huge change, though. I mean, there's no doubt about the fact that we are heading towards a point pretty rapidly whereby the majority of books will be bought online and they will be bought in digital form. This will probably mean that the general bookshop is going to disappear. You know, well, this is already happening with Waterstones, for example. If you talk to people in the industry in London, I'm published in London, you talk to people there, they expect that within 3 or 4 years, there will not be such a thing as an old-fashioned big bookshop. You know, you may have niche bookshops, you may have bookshops like W.H. Smith or whatever, which sell a lot of other stuff, or like Eason's, but the old-fashioned bookshop is probably a thing of the past. And I think there is a definite danger in relation to this. You know, there's something to be said here, which I think is quite important. People are going to say, oh, well, you know, I would say this, wouldn't I, because I make some of my living out of writing books and I'm in my 50s, you know, so I'm a kind of classic sort of conservative in relation to this. But copyright is not a conservative thing. You know, if you look at intellectual history, people, particularly writers, having some control over their own product has been one of the most liberating things in terms of intellectual history, because it means that the writer matters and that the writer is able to make a living of some kind out of what he or she does. If you don't have that, then what do you get? Well, you get either models of patronage, you know, which used to be you had to suck up to some king, some lords or the church or whatever to be your patron. Or you get another kind of patronage, which is basically all writers will work in universities. They'll all be academics. This has already happened with poetry, for example. Most poets are now academics, you know. And this has effects in terms of what gets written, what gets done, how intellectual life functions. And I do think it's really, really important, you know, that writers retain some sense of ownership over what it is they do. And that has to be translated into the digital age, and nobody quite knows how to do this yet.
It's also about, again, with music, there's that sense of the people deciding what they want to listen to an extent, over the record companies deciding what it is that they want to listen to. Is there a loss of power now for publishers to an extent that they were originally the ones who effectively gave us what they felt we should read? Are we getting to a point now? And I think because I want to move on to the genre aspect and how it's changed in Ireland, but do you think we're getting to a stage now where if you are a small writer in Ireland, if you are a genre writer, if you are somebody who's going to struggle to get into the relatively small amount of publishing houses in Ireland who don't have most of whom don't have a great amount of money, that actually it's quite empowering for the writer but also for the reader that opportunity is there to read pretty much whatever is available?
Absolutely fantastic. It's wonderful. I'm not complaining about it at all. It is a democratizing force, and it opens up publishing for people who wouldn't have had the opportunity before. And there's limited tastes among publishers. But I think you come back to, I think Anna said the key thing, you know, the key relationship for a writer is with an editor. It's not really with a publishing house. Like, you know, I've been published by 10 different publishers, I'd say, over the last 15 years. Why? Because I follow the same editor. Wherever the editor goes, I go, because that's the relationship. Now, that relationship costs money. Skilled editors they're really important people. And what you don't have in a sort of completely freewheeling online environment is editors. And editors prevent an awful lot of crap as well, you know. But they're not just passive, you know. They're also saying, actually, you know, somebody really has to write a book about X. And I'm going to be in the business of trying to identify the person who should do that and nursing that through a whole process. So on the one hand, with online, you'll get a lot more stuff published. On the other hand, there are skills that need to be paid for, and that there needs to be an economic model that allows those skills to be still in place.
Declan, genre, you mentioned 8-Ball Boogie, you said in Sligo, and you said what a lot of people would say, which is it's slightly deriding the idea that you could set a crime novel in Sligo. I mean, up until about 10 or 15 years ago, the idea that you could set any kind of thriller, crime thriller in Ireland seemed slightly ridiculous. That's changed utterly in the last 5 or 10 years. It's not necessarily for the economics of it, is it? Because they're not necessarily best-selling books, a lot of them, although some of them are. What is it that's made crime writing so big here?
Well, there's a lot of potential answers to that question. I would suggest that confidence is probably a big part of it. The idea that there is a market out there for genre fiction is huge.
Am I wrong? I mean, do they sell?
Not so well in this country, but then Ireland is not necessarily the best at early adopting. You know, I mean, you two had to go to the States and come back before, you know, people turned out in sufficient numbers to support you two back here, for example.
Nobody want to make the joke about wish they never come back, I just presumed.
but there are quite a number of Irish crime writers, for example, who are, you know, they're prize winning, they're best selling in the States. John Connolly, for example, doesn't even want to set a novel here in Ireland. In the UK and Germany, they're very, very popular. Not so popular here yet. I think that Ireland hasn't really... I mean, it has a great reputation for literary fiction. You know, it's world famous for its literary fiction, and justifiably so. Not so much for genre fiction. And really, I think not until... and I'm open to correction here, but Roddy Doyle's Barrytown trilogy, Roddy Doyle really kind of kicked the door down for genre fiction in this country. And he allowed a certain character to speak, you know, in their own vernacular and to entertain people of their own, you know, class and status and all the rest of it with entertaining stories about themselves. And to a certain extent, that's what genre fiction has to do with, whether it's crime or whether it's women's fiction or even if it's science fiction. It's about talking to people about the way they live now. You know, some examples are better than others. But I think it's in the last 10 years or so, and the Celtic Tiger was part of it, that idea that we got a bit of a swagger. Maybe we didn't deserve it, but we did develop a bit of a swagger. And people thought, well, you know, why can't I write? Why can't I compete with, you know, George Pelicanos or James Ellroy or one of these people who, you know, they're titans on the world stage. I think there's certainly an element of that.
Yeah, and because the other genre that's been incredibly successful in Ireland in recent years, between Owen Colfer and Derek Landy, yeah. two writers I think are two of the best writers we've produced in recent years, is obviously sort of young adult fiction.
Yeah.
Do you find as with The Real Rebecca, which is out recently, as a writer of teen fiction, do you find that you have to push a little harder to be taken seriously as a writer in Ireland?
I don't know. I suppose whether it's like I suppose I'm not really fighting against the literary establishment to get in yet. I'll start my campaign right now. But I don't know. I think we're actually quite good about children's fiction. I mean, the broadsheets do all review children's fiction. I mean, I sometimes review children's fiction for this very newspaper. I think it is taken relatively seriously, and I think that is largely to do with a few people like Robert Dunbar, the children's literature critic, who's been very vocal about this for years. But also readers are really embracing stuff like Owen Colfer and Darren Chatton and the Skulduggery Pleasant books by Derek Landy. And I don't know whether that's partly because a lot of them got taken up by British publishers, a lot of those authors, even though Owen Colfer did start at the O'Brien Press, who are my publishers and who have done an amazing job over the years in pushing Irish children's fiction. But it's definitely, it's something that's really changed over the last 30 years, because when I was a kid, there were virtually no Irish children's books in the 80s and 70s. And I think it is taken seriously now. And I think it is a combination of people plugging away and the Irish authors who have got taken up and become hugely successful all over the world, and who have also set their books very firmly in Ireland. You know, the Artemus Fowl books, he's very clearly Irish. The Derek Landy books, it's all very clearly Irish. And I think we're, you know, it's sort of like Declan was saying, we've got this confidence that, yeah, I don't, you know, I may not have set a children's book or read a children's book set in Ireland when I was a kid, but I'll do it now, and international audiences can like it, and they do. You know, so I think it works.
Well, before, I'm going to ask for a couple of recommendations from you in a moment, but just before we do that, Fintan, what's your view on this? Because I know you've written about how anonymity was important in terms of the crime genre, in terms of cities are important, and that's, you know, there are reasons why thriller writing has become so much bigger in Ireland. But generally, do you think genre fiction, which... And then there's a row at the moment in Britain about this. Ian M. Banks has put his name to a letter put together by science fiction writer Ian Hunt, who felt that the BBC and World Book Night didn't treat certainly the genre of science fiction and fantasy very well. But it's interesting, we still have to make that distinction as genre writing as opposed to literary fiction. Do you think Ireland is getting away from that?
I think gradually we are, and I think it's God knows it's about bloody time, you know. It's one of the most ridiculous distinctions you can imagine, because what's implied in it, of course, is that literary fiction isn't genre. You know, that James Joyce isn't working in a genre, that Beckett isn't working in a genre. You know, they may be working against certain perceptions. But if we were talking about movies, for example, I mean, if somebody said, well, actually, The Searchers can't be a good movie because it's a Western, you know, Western's
the
a genre. The Godfather is a crime movie, it's a gangster movie, so it can't be any good. Or in poetry, you know, I mean, genre is a set of rules. So anybody who writes sonnets, you know, is writing in a genre. So you know, Seamus Heaney is a genre writer when he's writing a sonnet, but not if he's writing another form. It makes no sense at all. And I think it is just about time we got rid of it. And I think paid some attention to the fact that actually so-called genre writing, like particularly crime writing, I think, has succeeded in dealing with some of the realities of Ireland over the last 15 years better than so-called literary fiction often has, you know, for all those reasons, you know, that it is an urban form, that it is a form that actually, you know, has to try to stay in touch with a changing reality. It has to be quite clear about what's going on in the place. And of course, perhaps not least because criminality has been a huge aspect of the reality of this place. You know, when you look back on it now, you think actually there should have been a lot more crime novels, because crime was really at the heart of our self-delusion.
So before we wrap up then, Declan, I mean, Crime Always Pays is just a brilliant website for anybody who has any interest in crime fiction or finding out about
So
give me a recommendation. Just, is there something at the moment, certainly maybe in terms of the Irish
Of things, just to pick up on what Fintan is saying. Gene Kerrigan has a new novel coming out next month called The Rage, and it is very much not even looking back, it's quite timely in relation to you know, the criminality that has gone, and not necessarily the kinds that will get the cops calling around in the paddy wagon, you know, the crimes that have really ripped this country off. Brian McGilloway has set a new novel in Derry called Little Girl Lost, which is quite interesting because it deals with the way the PSNI has changed its policing over the last 4 or 5 years. So things like that, I think crime fiction is quite good at. It's picking up on fairly recent developments, recent events, and being timely and relevant. That can undermine it to a certain extent, that it doesn't have the longevity that maybe, you know, a novel that of another stripe might have. But there are two novels that are certainly working out, looking out for over the next couple of months.
And Anna, anything in terms of Irish writing and writing for kids or teens?
There's been quite a lot of really good and funny books, which is a good development recently. There's the Bad Karma Diaries by Bridget Hurricane and Prim and Proper by Deirdre Sullivan, which is shortlisted for the BISTO Awards. So that really, you know, as somebody who wrote what was meant to be a funny book, I think it's great to see there's a rise in that, because there's been a tendency in Irish children's fiction to be a bit issues based, apart from the fantasy stuff, and a bit kind of serious problems for books. So it's good to see people letting loose and just writing comic novels with a bit of heart, which all these books are. So I'm optimistic about the future.
Well, before we finish up, I'm going to recommend Oliver Jeffers for a much younger readership.
Oh, yes.
But I saw somebody, we had a book sale in here, as we sometimes do for charity, with the books, the many books that come into the books desk, and somebody picked up Oliver Jeffers' The Heart in the Bottle recently, and I envied them because he didn't know what he was picking up, and he'll start with that and he will keep going now through all the other wonderfully illustrated
stories. It made me cry on
stories.
The bus when I took it home, The Heart in the Bottle. It is amazing.
So with that now, well, I'm going to go and have with my short list of panellists, I'm going to go and have a very heavy lunch while I decide on which one of you is the winner. But thank you very much to Fintan O'Toole, to Declan Burke and to Anna Carey. You can read Declan's piece in the Irish Times on Wednesday in Life and Cultures. You can read all our arts coverage during the week. You can catch us on irishtimes.com, and if you're interested, you can find me at twitter.com/ Shane Hegarty. Until next week, goodbye.